Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Sina Jeter-Nasland, who reads from and discusses her new book, Abundance, a novel of Marie Antoinette, published by Morrow. In the weeks to come, we have James McGreevy, T.A. Barron, Eric Larson, John Nesbitt, Les Claypool, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you all for coming this evening. I've been so excited to welcome once again to the Tattered Cover, Sina Jeter-Nasland. Ms. Nasland was last here for her wonderful book, Four Spirits, a novel that took place during the civil rights struggle in Birmingham, Alabama. This novel evoked the tenor of the times in such a remarkable fashion, the reader, whether they lived during those turbulent days or not, was able to sense the atmosphere of the city and to know those who played a part in the drama of that time. In her novel, Ahab's Wife, she again was able to take the reader to another time and place, this time early 19th century New England. She used the combination of fictional characters, Ahab's wife and others, and historical characters. Her new book, Abundance, has as a narrator Marie Antoinette, the ill-fated Queen of France. Arriving in France as a 14-year-old girl, Marie Antoinette meets for the first time her husband, the Dauphin, or Dauphin, it is, excuse me, heir to the throne of France, and begins a life of luxury and extravagance that will end during the Reign of Terror. We all know a little of this woman, her style, and her seemingly indifference to the reality of the state of her country. However, Ms. Nasland, using primary sources as her inspiration, brings to life a young woman caught in circumstances beyond her experience and control. Please join me in welcoming Sina Jeter-Nasland. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Margaret, for that lovely introduction. And my thanks to each and every one of you for being here. My husband John Morrison is here with us, and my nieces Amanda Jeter and Lisa Jeter Stuckey and her husband Greg are here. Where are you all? There you are. Okay. So I have to be able to, Mandy, move your chair out just a little bit so I can see you better. Thank you. But and also students and friends from Spalding University, where I'm the program director for a brief residency, Master of Fine Arts in Writing. It's wonderful to be here at the Tattered Cover in the new digs, which are already so comfortable and feel so much like home, I think, for many of us. I'm going to talk just a little bit about how I came to write the novel Abundance, a novel of Marie Antoinette. And then I'm going to read to you, and then you'll have a chance to ask questions or make comments as you like with this. I've been interested in the Marie Antoinette story since I was a child. When I was a child, it seemed to me that the Marie Antoinette story was a sort of reverse fairy tale. I had heard about the stories of people like Cinderella, who started out in cinders and ended up as princesses because they had been good, been nice girls, and been beautiful, and therefore they were rewarded. But this story starts with someone who was born to be a princess and who lost her position, her power, her head, her life, finally. And it seemed to me a cautionary tale. It wasn't the reassuring message of the fairy tale that goodness is rewarded and then you live happily ever after. But instead it said to me that no matter what position one attains, one is always vulnerable. This is the human condition. to be vulnerable. Doesn't matter whether you were born to it or whether you earn it all for yourself. We can never be safe, so it seemed to me. And then I thought, well, what does this mean then if none of us are ever safe? The answer that came to my mind was, it means we're all alike, basically, and that we should be kind to each other. We're all in the same boat. We're all equally vulnerable to whatever fortune may bring us. So it was a sort of a moral interpretation that I put on that story. But it was one, too, that it was a story that, as I say, represented the human condition to me, even though as a child I wouldn't have had that particular existentialist phrase to attach to the idea. I got the idea of writing a novel for this on this subject when I was on book tour with Ahab's wife. I had a couple of ideas for writing novels while I was on book tour. One of them came to me in Sydney, Australia, and it came to me because I picked up a newspaper in Sydney, Australia that had on its front page familiar photographs of four young African-American girls killed many years before in a church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, and there also was the photograph of their shattered church. What was new was the headline, which said that after all those years, nearly 40 years, finally, these two men were going to be tried for the murders of those girls. Well, when I was a college student at Birmingham Southern College, I had promised myself that if I ever became a writer, I would write about the civil rights movement and tell the truth about how bad it was in Birmingham. So then it was in Sydney, Australia, while I was on book tour with Ahab's wife, that that old promise came back to me and reached halfway around the world from Birmingham, Alabama to Sydney, Australia, and up through the decades, and grabbed my heart and squeezed and said, this is the time to write that book you always promised yourself that you would write if you've become a writer now. The other idea came to me in Darien, Georgia. I was staying in a very quaint bed and breakfast there, in a room called the women's room. It had a shelf of books, musty, dusty books, that were all biographies of famous women. One of these was a biography of Marie Antoinette by Stefan Zweig. It had been translated from German into English in the 1930s, so that book had been there quite a while. So I plucked it down because I had that old interest in her story and found a story that was exceedingly exciting. It's really a life or death story. At the same time, I found myself developing a quarrel with the author. I was, by the end of the book, in great rebellion against his attitude toward women in general and toward Marie Antoinette in particular. In his view, Marie Antoinette was an average woman. In fact, that's the subtitle of his book, Portrait of an Average Woman. And he doesn't think much of women in general. He sees women as being selfish, self-centered, materialistic, feather-brained, nothing very much going on in the intellectual department. And all of this, of course, I abhorred as a misogynist view of women. Whenever he tried to prove his point by quoting things that Marie Antoinette herself had said, the quotations, to me, undercut his interpretations. I found what she was saying to be sensitive and interesting and intelligent, unlike him. So I thought, perhaps this is a woman who has been maligned by history, a woman who had a powerful position, was therefore visible, and became a target, became someone who was demonized. And I thought I would like to look into that sometime. Well, some time passed while I was writing the other book, Four Spirits, and it was a good thing for me that time did pass, because during that period, Antonio Frazier came out with a new biography of Marie Antoinette that starts by debunking the idea that Marie Antoinette ever said what? Exactly, let them eat cake. Antonio Frazier said the phrase was used 100 years before Marie Antoinette ever came to France by the wife of Louis XIV, and that you can find it in the writing of Rousseau 30 years before Marie Antoinette ever came there. It was a phrase in common parlance, and while it was applied to her, there's no historical evidence that she ever said it. And in general, Antonio Frazier takes a more sympathetic view of Marie Antoinette, and she had done a great deal of the research that it would have been necessary for me to have done if I was going to take the stance that she had been demonized in various ways and misrepresented. So I, of course, read many other biographies, contemporary biographies. I went to Versailles and many times and stayed there one summer in 05 for a whole month so I could trot over to the chateau and the gardens, the Petit Trianon, the Hameau, whatever, during that time. So all of that just in way of a bit of background about my approach to the novel I've called Abundance. This novel is organized in five acts, like a Shakespearean tragedy. And this evening I'm going to give you a taste of each of those five acts by reading quite short selections from each act of the novel. I do see Marie Antoinette as a kind of tragic protagonist, someone who, through suffering, found or created for herself a nobility of character that she hadn't had before. Certainly she's not a flawless character. She had many flaws. But in the long run, one comes to admire her. And even Stefan Zweig came to admire her and admitted that she met her death with extraordinary courage. Okay, so we start off with Act 1, An Island in the Rhine River, May 1770. Like everyone, I am born naked. I do not refer to my actual birth, mercifully hidden in the silk folds of memory, but to my birth as a citizen of France, citoyen, they would say. Having shed all my clothing, I stand in a room on an island in the middle of the Rhine River, naked. My bare feet occupy for this moment a spot considered to be neutral between Austria and France. The sky blue silk of my discarded skirt wreathes my ankles, and I fancy I am standing barefooted in a puddle of pretty water. My chest is as flat as a shield, marked only by two pink rosebuds of nipples. I refuse to be afraid. In the months since I became 14, I've watched these pleasant rosebuds becoming a bit plump and pinker. Now the fingers and hands of my attendants are stretching toward my neck to remove a smooth circlet of Austrian pearls. Every month I will write my mother, Empress of Austria, and she to me, and our private letters will travel by our own couriers between France and Austria. When I try to picture my future husband, Louis Auguste, waiting for me in France, I can only envision my most dear mother, dressed in black, sitting behind me like a dark wedge at her desk. She awaits a courier bearing a white rectangular packet, the envelope that represents me. After I am married at Versailles, when Louis Auguste and I are alone in bed, certain events will follow. My mother has told me how to anticipate the meeting of our bodies and all the events of my life to come. We will copulate through the door at the bottom of my body. I become pregnant. 9 months after my marriage, I give birth to a baby. There will be many witnesses when my body, then age 15, opens to produce a future king. Years from then, after my husband has died, this baby will be the 17th Louis, King of France. This is what I know. The French word for him, the prince who will become my husband and king, is Dauphin, and the French word for me, who will be his bride, is the same, but with a small letter E, curled like a snail in its flinty house, at the end of the word, Dauphine. My darling Austrian ladies sail around me in their bright silk dresses, cerise and emerald, deep blue with yellow stripes, their throats and sleeves bedecked with frothy, drooping lace. Like dancers, they bend and swoop to gather the garments I've shed. Other ladies, standing patiently, hold my new French clothing, folded across their forearms, cloth of gold and filmy lavender. A flock of goosebumps sweeps across my bare flesh. The stern French require that I step forward naked, with no ribbon, memento, or ruby of Austrian design. To my ladies, I display my open palm so they may witness and affirm that I leave empty-handed and am beholden in no way to my native Austria. Resplendent in rich colors, they draw near in a solemn circle to regard my vacant hands. My nakedness complete now, I die as Maria Antonia, Archduchess of Austria, daughter of Maria Theresa, Empress of Austria. To be her worthy daughter, I will that my chilled flesh unpucker itself and become all smooth and lovely. Clothed in nothing but my own skin, described as pearly by some in its translucent sheen, I begin the donning of French clothes, no longer Maria Antonia, but my French self now, now named Marie Antoinette. In the next part I'm reading from, Marie Antoinette has been invited to a party by a woman she sometimes calls Madame Etiquette, and that is the Countess de Noailles. And she's going to a party hopeful of making friends. She's been lonely in Austria. And it's another passage that shows something of her naive, girlish, innocent nature when she first arrived in France. I'm so eager to reach the apartment of Madame de Noailles that I take the Dauphin's hand, and we all but run through the rooms of the Chateau de Versailles. And we do run through the Hall of Mirrors. I watch us in the mirrors as we hasten out of one frame and past another and another and another. It is the Versailles glide, smooth as ice skating, but at a fine clip. Our attendants can hardly keep up. We shall have fun, we shall have fun. I remember how we rode lately to the hounds, leaping across the ditches and over fences on horseback. Before my husband and I reach the entrance to the apartment of Madame Etiquette, we can smell the aroma of roast pork and apples and cinnamon and game birds stuffed with stage and something that must be a venison stew with much of celery and onions, all of the wonderful meaty smells and dishes that we shall have to forego when Carnival is done and Lent has us in its fishy 40-day grip. I know the Dauphin's appetite is keen, and everyone will attend the dance with a special eagerness to make merry. Over the winter months without his beloved hunting, my husband has put on flesh. When the door opens, whom do I see but the beautiful Princess de Lamballe? She is accompanied by her father-in-law, the Duc de Penthèvre, the richest man in France, next to the king. His valet carries two simple pots of creamy clay holding living violets. With graceful gestures, the good Penthèvre indicates that one is for his hostess and the other is for his beautiful widowed daughter-in-law. To my amazement, the Princess de Lamballe bursts into tears. Rapidly, a seat is placed behind her, and half fainting, she sits upon it and weeps. "Their sweetness is too great," she says, wiping her eyes. To my second amazement, I find that tears have quickly come to my own eyes and are ready to spill. So appealing are the flowers that they appear to have been dug from the forest floor and brought by courier in all their freshness. "She is overwhelmed by their naturalness," the Duke says sympathetically of his daughter-in-law, and he gestures to have the potted violets removed. I find that I am on my knees beside the princess, touching her hand and looking into her eyes to console her. "I too," I say, "have been touched by the poignancy of the faces of violets. When I rode to the hounds in the forest of Campania, I saw them growing at the root of a mighty tree." "Don't take them away," the sensitive princess sobs. "But, dearest Papa, may I make a present of my pot to the Dauphin, whose sensibility I share?" And suddenly she smiles at me. The sun has come out from behind the cloud, and I am enchanted by the beauty of her wide-spaced blue eyes and the steadiness of her gaze. She is neither afraid of me nor impressed by my position. It is myself whom she claims as a kindred spirit. And then I recall that she is of German origin, like myself. She continues to smile at me and clutches my hand in return, and I think of Charlotte, my sister, and how, when we were girls at Schönbrunn, we would gaze into each other's eyes and hold the gaze till the exact thought passed from one mind to the other without a single word spoken. So it is now, and my heart fills itself and sighs with happiness, for I have found a friend. "And do you love little dogs, too?" I say, smiling cheerfully. And kittens, she says, in rapturous burst. A few tears brim over the edges of her eyes and course down her cheeks, but she bravely fights them off. And hippopotami, I exclaim. She is caught off guard and says, I do not know hippopotami. What are they? It turns out that she has not heard of rhinoceroses or giraffes either, and I am glad, because for once I am not the most ignorant person in a conversation. With some fear, I'm almost trembling, I ask her if she likes to read. Sometimes, she says, and she looks troubled, as though she fears her answer may not be adequate. I am the same, I say. For a moment, I simply regard her. She is elaborately and beautifully dressed as I am, at great expense. What is it I want to share with her? My mind scrambles to find some emblem of myself. I think of the little topiary trees in the garden here at Versailles. It is their opposite that I want. I say, the forest is always murmuring. The great trees talk to one another with the rustling of their leaves. She says, they put their heads together. Then she smiles, and share secrets like sisters. Already she loves me. I mind my husband's neglect a little less now. Well, the neglect of Louis XVI was famous, was infamous. The marriage was not consummated on the night of the wedding, or the next night, or the next night, or the next year, or the next year, not for 7.5 years. And this was a cause of great embarrassment to Marie Antoinette, who was perfectly willing. Louis XVI was simply not very interested, and he was very shy and very clumsy. He was only 15 to her 14 when she arrived. But it was a political problem, because Marie Antoinette had been sent to France to seal an alliance between her mother's country, Austria, and France. And part of this alliance depended on their producing together an heir to the throne, a male child. And, of course, Marie Antoinette was solidly blamed for this, even though the marriage was not consummated and there was really nothing she could do about it. She tried every day to do something about it, and he was simply not very responsive. Well, finally, her mother, with whom she had an active correspondence all the time, she both loved and feared her mother, and her mother was always micromanaging Marie Antoinette. Finally, the mother sent Marie Antoinette's older brother, Joseph II, from Austria to France to give the couple marriage counseling, really sex counseling, about what to do when they got in bed. He was actually very effective at this. They had quite frank discussions describing what they did and did not do, and he told them what they should do. But he also thought Marie Antoinette needed a lot of advice, and so he wrote down a number of pieces of advice and left them with her before he left Versailles. And so I'm going to read, these are actually letters from Joseph II. If any of you have seen the current production at Denver Center Stage of Amadeus, you've seen Joseph II. He's a character in that play, the same person whose words I'm about to read to you. It's a delightful play. If you haven't been, I recommend it most heartily to you. So these are the words of Joseph II to Marie Antoinette. For her to read after he's left. Are you not bored or absent-minded when he touches or talks to you? If so, is it not inconsiderate of you to expect a man who has no experience with carnal pleasures to be able to find intimacy, to be aroused, and to bring his love to a successful climax? You must focus your attention on creating a physical link between you, for that is the strongest link you can forge to happiness in your life. You must never allow yourself to feel discouraged, and you must always give him hope that he will be the sire of children. Never give up. Never despair. Your only power is in your charm and friendship. I tremble, not only for your happiness, but for your safety. I have seen enough in this country to know that the finances and welfare of the state are in a desperate condition. Your marriage and the lack of an heir is also a desperate matter. In the long run, perhaps much sooner than anyone apprehends, it will be impossible for France to continue as it has. The revolution will be cruel, and I am sorry to say that it will be of your own making. This chapter from Act 3 is called A Bath, 18 August 1777, nearly 7.5 years later. Sometimes the water in the bath is of such a compatible temperature that it is bliss to submerge my body in the fragrant liquid. I wonder if before the fall the waters of Eden were just as these, and that of all Eve's pleasures, walking among the open flowers and fondling the rounded fruits of the garden, perhaps Eve preferred bathing. This morning the water feels like warmed silk. Lifting up the hem of my gauze bathing dress, I point my toes down as my foot enters my bath. The water's smoothness creeps over my arch and encloses my ankle like the finest stocking, and then up my leg almost to the knee. Then the other foot follows. As I lower myself entirely into this universe of comfort, the aroma of attar of rose with tincture of orange is released. When I am seated in my bath, I cannot resist raking my fingers forward in the water to further liberate the fragrance. I submerge the globular sea sponge until its cells and fissures are filled with warmth, and then my attendant squeezes water from the sponge over my back, and next she rubs my shoulders and spine with a circular stroke that stimulates the circulation. My flesh develops an appetite for the motion of the sponge, and then I take it from my attendant and stroke my bare neck and then my breasts myself. Scooting my buttocks forward in the tub, I submerge myself up to my neck. I twirl myself in the warmth so that my breasts hang down into the water and twirl around again. My bathing dress twists around my body. If only I had a lovely emerald green tail to splash, though I make quite a nice splash in my rotation. I see my attendants are smiling at my play, but their smiles are ones of understanding. "The king is passing," my attendant suddenly whispers. "He is walking back and forth just outside the door." For just a moment, I imagine she refers to the old king, Louis XV, whose luminous eye always took on a new luster when he beheld unexpected feminine beauty, even when I was 15 and quite flat. I reply, "Let him come in." Skillfully, she opens the door as he passes, and with the same gesture, my attendant slips silently away. The king stands in the open door and looks at me. My hair pinned atop my head hangs half-loosened in wet ringlets. Placing my hands on the sides of the tub, I suddenly rise, my muslin gown quite transparent and clinging to my body. The water rushes off me as though I am a living fountain. "Would you be so kind as to help me?" I say, and I hold out my hand. Gallantly, my husband holds out his hand to steady me as I step over the high edge of the bath. The water from my gown and body streams onto the floor. Tenderly, he pushes the loose, wet sleeve over my shoulder on one side and then the other. I raise my shoulders from the slumping bodice so that my breasts emerge. With a gentle hand, my husband shoves the sodden gown down my thighs to wreathe my feet. When I step on the fabric, I feel water squish between my toes. Wearing nothing more than the blue ribbon tying up my hair, I follow him as he hands me a towel and leads me to our bed. And after this episode in the bath, which is a historically accurate thing, by the way, of what happened and when it happened and how it happened, Marie Antoinette does eventually become pregnant, and she has 4 children. So two of the children grow to adulthood. 2 of them die earlier. She also, during this period of her life, when she's pregnant for the first time, meets again the Swedish Count Axel von Fersen. She's met him before when she was 18, and they've enjoyed talking to each other at an opera ball. He's been gone for 4 years or so, and now he comes back, and immediately they become very fast friends. Whether they became lovers or not is a matter of debate among biographers. But what is important is the quality of the friendship that they had, the understanding they had of each other, and the affection they had for each other. So Marie Antoinette, in this middle period of her life, is having children, which is something that she's supposed to be doing. She's good friends with the king. He never particularly likes to make love to his wife. He's frank about that, but he thinks it's his royal duty, and he does it. But she also has a number of women friends, the Princess de Lamballe, and above all, her friend, Axel von Fersen. However, one of the decisions of Louis XVI in this time is to aid the American War for Independence. And he does this not for any love of liberty of those in America, but to weaken an enemy, that is England, to deprive England of its colonies. And it's a gesture that results in severe financial hardship for France. Also, the weather becomes quite bad. There are terrible harvests for a couple of years. The people are hungry. There has been a need for reform in the social structure of France for years, dating back years and years. And the royal family find themselves in a worse and worse position, not supported by their own nobility, whom they would tax if they could, but the nobility resists that. So eventually, Louis XVI finds it necessary to convene the Estates General, which has not been convened for over 170 years in France. And this is really the beginning of the end of the monarchy when he calls together the Estates General. So in the fourth act, we begin to see things falling apart for the entire royal family and for the concept of monarchy in France. This chapter is called In the Town of Versailles, May 1789. From the parish church named Notre Dame, here in the town of Versailles, at the head of the procession of the deputies of the Estates General, the king and I follow the canopy hovering over the Blessed Sacrament. The members of the three estates, nobility, clergy, and commoners, each walk with their own groups. Slowly we cross the Place d'Armes. The king and I turn our heads toward the window in one of the royal stables for the Dauphin to see us pass. This is their son, one of two sons, their older son, who is in line to be the future king of France. Yes, there he is, his tiny, frail body propped up on a great pile of cushions. How bravely he smiles at us, his parents, as we pass him below. He is a noble child. Tears try to flood my eyes, but I must be as brave as he is, only age 8. It is his spirit that is noble, a fact of much greater importance than any social position can convey. If these people aspire to nobility, let them practice courage and compassion. A little child could lead them. Having passed this station, I fasten my eyes again on the sacrament as it leads the way from the local church of Notre Dame to the church of Saint-Louis. Every window is filled with spectators, and lining the streets are vast crowds who sometimes cheer. Often when they see me, a dark cloud and a dark silence falls. I lift my head higher. It is a dazzling sunny day. No one here has ever witnessed such an historic event. The Estates General will convene tomorrow here in the town of Versailles. We are right to entreat God's guidance today, all of us. Some of these deputies have disavowed God or renamed him simply as the supreme being who cares little for the fate of humans. I do not believe that. Earlier, we sat for a moment when the Dauphin, who sometimes struggles to breathe, his spine has become quite crooked and he can hardly stand erect. Some of the vertebrae jut out. He has become embarrassed by his hunchback appearance and does not like to be seen unless he can trust in the love of his visitor. Your dress is very beautiful, the Dauphin said to me quietly, and I was glad that he took pleasure in the splendor of my wide court dress, made of silver cloth a la shimmer wherever the light touches it. The king is dressed in cloth of gold studded with brilliants. He sparkles all over as though touched by a magic wand with diamond buttons and shoe buckles, carrying a diamond sword and decorated by the Order of the Golden Fleece and the Order of Saint-Esprit. He wears the enormous diamond known as the Regent, and my hair is ornamented with a flawless and star-like diamond named the Sancy. My papa must be the king of enchantment as well as of France, the Dauphin said. Then he began to cough, and I could see a flush of feverish red cross his face. Gallantly, he calmed his heaving and managed to ask, Is light more silvery or gold? I gasped and said, My darling, I asked the same question when I rode many days across Europe inside the regal coaches to meet your father. At the Church of Saint Louis, the bishop sermonizes about the riches of the nobility in contrast to the poverty of the people. I watch the eyelids of the kings half hood his eyes. Then they completely close. So it is with him. He escapes into sleep when he cannot hunt in the countryside. I can only hope that he does not snore. At the end of the sermon, the king is awakened by the applause. In the old days, we were taught it was disrespectful to applaud when the Blessed Sacrament was uncovered. These are a people lacking in manners, cruel and wild. Here in the Church of Saint Louis, I vow always to treat the people of France with civility in the hope that it will be returned to me and my family. Perhaps such a hope as mine is to be pitied. At the opening of the Assembly of the Estates, 4 May, the king stands in his majestic robe, sparkling with jewels. He invites me to be seated, but I curtsy and continue to stand. From his high throne, just as he begins to speak, a shaft of sunlight enters through a gap in the curtains and shines on his face like the approval of God. I wish the Dauphin were well enough to see his father, so blessed by heaven. My thoughts drift to the Dauphin. I think of my young son's great tenderness to me and how when he asked me to eat my favorite dinner with him in his room, I swallowed more tears than bread. For all his frail condition, I rejoice to have given birth to such a child. I recall how when he wanted to be carried out into the garden, so like his mother in his love of flowers, he asked not to be carried by a certain valet. "For he always hurts me," my son said. When someone told him that the valet does all he can to ease him and that his feelings would be hurt if his services were declined, the Dauphin replied, "Ring at once, then. I would rather suffer a little than cause any pain to this worthy man." Mature beyond his years, the child is a saint of patience, and as I sit in this public place listening to political speeches, I swallow and swallow the tears that run down the inside of my throat, for I will not let them see me weep, lest they think they have some power over me. It is after midnight, and my child has just died. I look at his tortured body and am glad his spirit is with God. 4 June, 1789. At the same time, my heart is broken. I run to the window, throw it open to the darkness, look down into the neglected garden. The redolent aroma of honeysuckle, roses, jasmine, all in decay, floods into the room. Well, it seems symbolically fitting that as the monarchy is losing its power, so the little heir to the throne literally dies at that same time. Conditions grow worse in France. And finally, the royal family is forced to leave Versailles and to go to Paris. The market women, the fishwives of Paris, march out to Versailles and insist that they go. For a while, it looks as though they may be killed. And Marie Antoinette's bedroom is attacked. She's able to slip away through a secret door in the back of the room. But members of the Swiss Guard are killed. They're taken to the Tuileries to be watched. The fear of the revolution becomes that the king and queen may form an alliance with foreign powers in order to mount a counter-revolution. But they have some freedom at the Tuileries for a while. Then they decide to try to escape. They almost do so. Count Axel von Fersen himself serves as the coachman to drive them out of Paris, but the king won't let Fersen drive them all the way out. He wants to be in control himself. Fersen is an experienced soldier, and he probably could have gotten them out, but instead they're stopped 16 miles short of the border, taken back to the Tuileries. Of course, they're in great disgrace now and very closely watched. The Tuileries are stormed. Many people are killed. Their lives are saved, but they're moved again to a medieval palace referred to as the Temple because it had belonged to the Knights Templar. And they're watched very closely indeed. Today, 21 September 1792, we hear from the town criers who are paid by our friends to shout the news, particularly loudly as they pass by the tower. We learn that monarchy in France no longer exists. The king does not raise his eyes from his book. He turns a page, and his eyes began their ceaseless travel again from left to right. I detect no change in his large, impassive face. Slowly I rise from my chair and make my way to the bed. All strength has gone from me. I cannot even sit up. In bed, I lie on my back so that both ears will be open as I listen to the details of the news proclaimed loudly from the street below. France is to be ruled by a national convention, the members of which are to be elected. As for the royal family, our name is now Capet. My husband is Louis Capet, the name of ancestors who ruled France until the year 1328. This year is no longer 1792. It is the year one, heralded into being by the blowing of trumpets all over Paris. The sound of trumpets has a certain brightness to it. For some trumpets, the sound is silvery. For others, it has the mellow fullness of gold. I prefer any musical sound to that of human voices growling their hatred. France has its borders to look to now. The European powers see this country as weak. They would like to defeat this new regime, not to rescue us, but to bite off pieces of France for which they have long hungered. And what is to be our fate? They take the king away from us, to the great tower. The children and I are devastated. We make no attempt to staunch the flow of tears and our words of supplication to those who control our destiny. Elizabeth, the younger sister of the king, throws herself onto her knees. To our surprise and great joy, they are moved. They allow us to take our meals together under the condition that we speak in loud, clear French. Nonetheless, sometimes I send my husband, when he's away from us, a private message, a message hidden in a hollow cut into a peach or in a cavity concealed inside a macaroon. We all continue to eat very well off silver, and the king has wine. At the end of October, the children and I join the king in the great tower with newly decorated rooms, including a toilet made in the English style, flushed with water. 11 December, 1792. The sound of snare drums rolls over my heart. Something of enormous importance is about to occur. We can hear the regular footsteps of soldiers approaching us, ascending the stairs. The volley of the drums becomes louder and louder till they fling open the door to our rooms. Pétion stands before us to read a decree to Louis Capet. It is a lengthy, grinding denunciation for treason, asserting that Louis, quote, left France as a fugitive with the intention of returning as a conqueror. Capet is not my name, my husband replies mildly. That detail is inaccurate, as are many others. Pétion says, these children cannot remain under the influence of both their parents. One of you will be taken from them. Which one? Stricken to the core, I can only gasp and look at my husband. He gazes at me fondly, even with the slightest of smiles, and says, of course our children must remain under the care and protection of their noble mother. The trial is held, and Louis XVI is sentenced to death. We will see him to say goodbye, I assure the children and Elizabeth. We will tell him of our love for him, that is all that is left, and our bottomless sorrow. And here is the king standing before us, a huge man, his eyes full of sadness and regret. Immediately he speaks to his son about the necessity of forgiveness of one's enemies. I do not hate them, he says, and you must never hate them. When morning breaks, someone arrives for a prayer book, but the king does not come to us again. We are told he is being taken in a closed carriage to the place of execution. Very far away, very faintly, after waiting and praying, we hear drumming. It is 10:30 in the morning of 20 January. That shout, that awful, joyful shout so far away, it must mean the king is dead. Elizabeth explodes with hatred. The monsters, the monsters! Now they are satisfied. I had hoped that they would not come for me at night, but it is the dead of night, 2 o'clock in the morning, when we are awakened. They allow me no privacy for changing into a dress, but watch me. I am allowed to take a few items with me, including a handkerchief. I gather these meager things with an outward calm, but my heart is crying for my children and for my dear sister, who must now try to care for them by herself. In answer to my sister's urgent inquiry, they say that I am to be taken to an ancient prison called the Conciergerie, on the Ile de la Cité in the midst of the Seine River. I ask nothing, I feel nothing, but I will my numb hands and feet to do what they must do and to go where they must go in their little circuit around my chamber. They allow little time to say farewell, but what opportunity I have, I use to tell my daughter, my Marie-Thérèse, to obey her aunt, to look upon her as a second mother, to help her brother. With the lips of my most tender love, I kiss them each farewell. I know that my sister will be a rock of strength and that she will instruct my daughter to open her heart to God. My little son, I dare not think his name. She will care for him. The guards lead me downstairs and I strike my head, it seems. Are you injured? Someone asks. In my mind, I hear the sound my skull must have just made against a low wooden beam, but I feel nothing. No, I reply to the guard's question. Nothing can hurt me now. In the conciergerie, Marie Antoinette makes friends with the people who have been assigned to watch her and to be her keepers. Two of them are women, an older woman and a younger woman. One day, when both guards are so bored with their game that they fall asleep with fans of cards in their hands, Madame Richard comes to me and sits down at the table. What do you knit? She asks. A pair of stockings with a rosy ladder up the side, I say. They are for you. She is touched, presses her fingers against her throat. My stockings have always been plain, she replies. She lifts her skirt and thrusts out a black leg. I nod and continue the work of my fingers. Once I heard a story, she says. Perhaps it was a fairy tale, not really about you and the king at all. A story? I ask. Yes, a pretty story, she says. Then I would like to hear it, I say. In your old country, where there were mountains, you loved to ride sleds? Yes, I say, and to go sleigh riding behind a swift horse. The king and I enjoy sleigh riding here many times. But one time, she said, it being summer here in France, one time there was no snow, but you wanted to go sleigh riding. You confided so to the king one hot evening. In the night, while you slept, he had the street of your little play village covered with sugar. And when you woke up, you looked out and all was sparkling white. Your windowsill was heaped with it. You kissed the king. He said, your sleigh awaits. You looked out and saw snow piled everywhere. It looked like snow, and a white horse bedecked with silver bells. You ran out and climbed in and put a red robe trimmed in ermine fur around your shoulders, and with the king beside you holding the reins, you took a sleigh ride as though it were frosty winter. Is it true? Perhaps, I say, not in every part. I can see the pleasure she takes in imagining the pictures. Is it true, she says, that you were loved so splendidly? Suddenly I see the image of Axel von Fersen, my greatest friend, sitting on the high box of the Berlin, with the straps of leather, the reins hanging loosely in his gloved hands. And I imagine the king beside him, ready to play the role of coachman for my sake. How we were all true friends. Yes, I say, I was loved so splendidly. And with that, I stop. So that's kind of a quick sleigh ride through the five acts of the novel, from the naive and innocent Marie Antoinette to a person of maturity and responsibility, sensitivity, to really whoever crossed her path. As she mounted the steps to the guillotine, history records, and I duly use as much of the historical phrases, sentences as I can in my book, history records that she stepped on the foot of the executioner. And she stopped and says, "Pardon me, I did not mean to do it." So, an empty-headed villain, hard-hearted, a demon? I don't think so. But Of course, there are many views of Marie Antoinette, and one must never forget that the French people had suffered for centuries at the hands of the social system that was there. Nonetheless, the revolution was without mercy and executed people simply for who they were, not for any individual acts that they had done. Well, any questions, any comments, any thoughts about all of this? Yes? The question is about the letters I've included in the novel, Abundance, that passed between Marie Antoinette and her mother. And the question is, are they historically accurate? They are historically accurate, but they're not exact replicas of the letters because sometimes I omitted certain things or squeezed together two letters and put them in one time frame or changed. There are many ways the French can be translated in it. But, yes, by and large, they are the letters. You can read the letters in a collection by Olivier Bernier called Secrets of Marie Antoinette, and I mention it in the acknowledgments in the back of the book there. It was through these letters that I felt I really began to understand Marie Antoinette. These were the letters that I had read partially quoted in the old biography and taken such issue with his interpretation of the things that she had to say. This book, Abundance, is written in the first person, and it's a challenge to find the voice that seems authentic. I felt that reading the letters was my key to her voice and her inner life. Another help was to read things that people said about her, which they put in their own diaries or memoirs or letters, and sometimes they would quote her directly, as in the guillotine story. There's a when she first came to France, she crossed into the city of Strasbourg, which is in France, so it has a German name. And their speeches of welcome, the people were nuts to see her, and they had a tremendous celebration. I mean, nuts in the sense of wildly enthusiastic. It's recorded that she, when the dignitaries began to welcome her, she spoke up and said, "Please speak to me only in French from now on and not in German." And that was an indication of how much she wanted to embrace her role. What she said was passed back through the crowd, and of course she couldn't have said anything that would be better press for herself with the people than that. And her life was marked by those very apt, very gracious comments. She had a brilliant social sense that was rooted in her awareness of the total situation and also in her kindness and her wish to make other people feel happy and at ease. Is there another question? Other questions, thoughts, comments? It's always hard to do this. Yes. Do I speak French and or German is the question. I started studying French when I was a high school freshman at age 13, and I learned to read it to some extent. My pronunciation of French was bad then, and it remains bad today. I studied French in college. I studied PhD French as a graduate student. Last summer I took another course in French. This next summer I'll go back and do an intensive course. So I'm desirous of learning to speak the language better. I can read it pretty well, but I don't speak it very well. I also studied German in college and did PhD German as well. But I've not kept up the German to the same extent. I can't read it even nearly as well as I can the French. I wish I could do better with it, but I'm still trying. One of the fun things about writing books is you get interested in the subject matter and you continue that interest. I'm still doing research on whaling in 19th century New England as a holdover from my book Ahab's Wife. And I'm still interested, of course, in the civil rights movement in Birmingham as well. Any other questions or thoughts or comments about this? What's next? Well, I'm not sure. I have ideas for three more novels. Since I've been here in Denver, ideas have really come tumbling out. It's such a inspiring place to be with the theater here and the art museum, and my husband's here too, so it's an inspiring little visit for me, and I love it when I'm traveling with one book to have one eye sort of out, one ear out, listening to what I might want to do next. It's a matter of finding time to write these books. But I love doing it, and I always feel good after the first draft is completed. Then I have something instead of nothing, and I can come back to it and revise it and amplify it and polish it up. And I always think of a person who might make a sculpture of wood and how such a person's hands probably fall in love with the wood, and the sculptor loves to touch it again, to polish it a little bit more, to make this line a little clearer in it. And that's the way I feel about revision of the novels. I love to do the revision. Yes. The question is, how long did it take to complete Ahab's Wife? It took me 2 years to get the first draft, and then another 2 years to revise it from beginning to end four times. That's not counting the revisions of separate passages, which I know I revised the beginning at least 50 times, because I know how I revised it every day, and I know how long that took. It was surprising to me that the period of revision exactly mirrored the period of time for the first draft, and I found that true of the other books, too, that it takes as much time to revise them as it does to get the first draft. But for me, it's much easier work, and I happen just to have a lot of patience with it. I'm never impatient with it. I always want it to be better. I have friends who read my novels for me who are interested in writing. A lot of them are former students of mine. And I get their feedback. I don't take all of anybody's advice, but I usually take some of everybody's advice. And it's very helpful to see how the communication is occurring by getting some feedback along the way. Yes. Yes, the question is, where am I from? And I'm from originally Birmingham, Alabama, but I live now in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm not sure I heard your question. Why so many good writers from the South? I don't know. You know, I think there are good writers everywhere. I don't think it's the South has a special purchase on good writing, really. In my own case, there were storytellers in my family, and I suppose that's a rather Southern tradition. Also, I was read to a lot as a child, and my good luck was to have a mother who loved literature and was happy to read aloud to me. So that's where my interest as a writer seems to be lodged. I had an older brother who taught me how to imagine when I was about I guess, four, and he was maybe six. This is my next older brother, John. And he got out the piano bench and a vanity bench and put cushions on them and told me to get on the smaller one, which was a little bit behind the larger one, his. And he said, now we were going to ride these horses over the plains. And I suddenly realized, well, this is what you do. You imagine things. You pretend. So he introduced me into that mode of thought, and we spent a lot of time imagining stories. So I was helped by an immediate tutor, shall I say. Yes. Who are the strong women influences in my life? Well, certainly my last three novels, including Abundance, are full of strong women characters, and it is something that I seem to naturally want to write about. I think that there certainly were individuals in my life who helped me in various ways, besides members of my families. My teachers were very kind to me when I was growing up, and I felt inspired by them. In some ways, it was a little unfortunate for me because I tended to identify more with the teachers than with the other students in class, so there was a kind of social isolation as a result of that. But the teachers just had more interesting minds, in my opinion. So, and, you know, they suggested things for me to read, and just in their position as teachers, they represented strength. But more than that, independence of thought, I think. And they were imaginative people as well. So I also found role models, certainly in my reading. Laura Ingalls Wilder, the author of the Little House books, showed me at an early age that a person could live a life and then write about it if you wanted to. And Jo March in Little Women, who inspired so many writers, was there for me. So was Anne of Green Gables. She was a serious student. She wanted to be the best student in her class, and I loved reading about her ambition to do well in school. She took school seriously. So those fictive models served me very well, too, to draw me into the world of writing. Anything else anybody wants to ask? Well, let me say thank you for your kind attention, and I'm going to sit up here and sign books for anyone you like. I'm happy to sign all of the books for your holiday gift giving as well as for yourselves at this time. And my thanks again to the Tattered Cover for inviting me to be here. Good night.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for James McGreevy, T.A. Barron, Eric Larson, John Nesbitt, Les Claypool, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 11th, 2006.